You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 82. This minute begins with Shaw fighting the crew members, trying to put her in cryo, and ends with her undressing to enter the med pod. And for the next few episodes, I'll be joined by Luke Milton from Dungeons & Drongos, a roleplay podcast set in Fantasy Australia. Hello, Luke.
Hey, I'm glad you clarified that for me, because I watched this minute without the sound, and it looked to me like she was running down the corridor desperate to take a shit in that thing.
Yeah, I can see where that confusion comes in.
Yeah, she had some cramps happening there, didn't she?
You know what? Maybe for Alien Covenant, I should just assign minutes to people and tell them not to watch the entire movie, and they can tell me what they think the plot is.
Yeah, because, I mean, all the finer details, like, that's your job.
Yeah.
You know, you can rein all that in. I'm just thinking, here is a sweaty lady who's got some very crook guts, who is gunning it down the corridor, going, like, look... I don't know if that thing's a toilet, because I'm on a spaceship, but it's about as secluded as anything I've seen up until this point. I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to fill it with burrito diarrhea. And you know, she's even at the point where she's like, the whole back of my gown is going to be covered in shit. I need to dump this thing before I get
should
in
have
there.
Worn and, the brown smock.
Yeah, exactly.
So, as you can probably tell, dear listener, Luke is where I basically got my media analysis skills from. Just from this minute alone, such insightful observations, I think.
Well, that was my academic approach, and yes. I figure we'll lead into a comedy approach. Already.
I was also going to mention that you also do a podcast called ScarJo A Go-Go, which it's been on hiatus for a little while now, but it is what inspired me to do Prometheus by Minute. I mean, also the other Movies by Minute podcast too, obviously. But yeah, what you do on ScarJo A Go-Go is you've looked at every single one of her films and just focused on her role in them, and I think your observations are really great, and, I mean, I always like ScarJo, but I'm definitely a fan of her even more so now.
Yeah, just looking at a performance, and you notice all these patterns and tropes that kind of appear, sort of thematic things that I guess she brings as an actress. You really get to appreciate, like, you know, you hear people say, oh, I like this actor, or I don't like this actor, or whatever, and you realize that really it comes down to the quality of the director and the project. I mean, when Scarlett's working with really great directors and, you know, you see really great performances, obviously, and when it's not, you don't.
Yeah, and I didn't really think about that before, but you've got a background in directing for theatre, and so I get you are thinking from the actor's perspective, which I normally don't. I'm such a costume-focused person.
Yeah, and I think even when someone's really giving it their all and doing a really strong performance, everything else in the film has to support that, from the camera work to the setup to the editing. And I think, you know, sometimes you can see people really gunning it and really probably doing not a bad job, but the everything around them's not matching what they're doing and it looks awkward.
Yeah, I think Fassbender and Noomi Rapace, they have suffered from that a little bit, where they are very fearless actors. They will give it 110%, but the director might not be on the same page with them, but thankfully Ridley seems to be very much an actor's director.
Yeah, an example, like a pop example I'd think of to sort of illustrate what I'm saying there would be Benedict Cumberbatch in Doctor Strange. Like, at the beginning, when he's all full of anguish and looking out windows and clenching his fists and, you know, oh my God, what's happening to me? It's just not supporting him. Like, he looks kind of awkward and he looks like he's overdoing it. And I think there are ways to shoot that and present that material and to set a tone that wouldn't have resulted in that. And I think that often happens when you've got a star who's sort of known as being a accomplished actor and a director that perhaps is not as comfortable, and you sort of feel like maybe they're a bit shy about pulling the actor back, or conversely sort of pushing what they're doing forward.
Do you think that's more of an issue for film rather than stage, because film has way more layers and the actor doesn't really see the final process until much later?
No, I still think there's, it's the director's job to pull all those pieces together, because you can certainly have an issue where people feel like they're performing in a different film or a different production. My pop culture example for that is Bad Teacher, where they are all in very different movies.
Yes.
Like Timberlake's playing this really broad kind of wacky comedy character, and Jason Segel is like, he's in a like an Apatow movie.
Mm.
And everybody's doing a different style of comedy and it just never meshes. And a director really needs to be able to go, okay, look, we've got to pull all these inconsistencies together and get you all in the same world. And I wonder, like, to pull this back to Prometheus, which is why we're here, that sort of feeling of inconsistency is perhaps what worries people about this film. Like, I know people have huge problems with the two guys deciding they're going to pat that snake.
Yes.
And it just seems like it's inconsistent with the world that's been created up until that point.
Yeah, in that minute we sort of said that it feels like Ridley, it was experimenting with this odd sense of humour. You see that with David a lot. And the Milburn and Fifield scene's another example of this very strange sense of humour, which I think you either have to go bigger or don't do it at all. It's in this weird middle ground of, where did that come
from? But I agree with the concept of doing something like this, because I think... Mm. Audiences are far too quick to just go, hey, this is shit, I don't like this, but aren't very good at articulating what worked, what didn't work. And you know, I'm not saying that everybody has to be a critic or analyze everything. I mean, look, if you go and see movies just to have fun and relax, and you come out and you go, well, look, I didn't connect with that, I think that's absolutely fine.
Mm.
You don't have to dig any deeper into something that you didn't enjoy. But at the same time, I think once people go to that point of saying, well, I'm going to be on the internet and I'm going to like bitch about this and tell everyone how shit it was and how it was the worst thing ever and complain about the snake or the rolling spaceship or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think once you're pretending to be an expert, you need to have more substance behind it.
Yeah, this film is very much the victim of that. And I've talked about it a few times, but just again, a few episodes ago, where I was just talking about fan theories and fan discussion, and there's a real lack of understanding of how the industry works or how filmmaking works. And so it is fascinating how a layman audience member engages with this stuff compared to a critic or someone who does have a history of either filmmaking or storytelling in some capacity.
I also think that, you know, Ridley Scott's not an idiot. Like, whether you like this film or not, he's clearly got some thinking or vision behind it and something that he wants to express. And I think it's really quite disingenuous to have that knee-jerk reaction to something and then think that you know better than everybody who worked on it. And it's not to say that everything's successful, but I think it's interesting to then sit and look at it and go, well, why did they make that choice? As opposed to saying, well, that's a shitty choice.
Yeah, and that's what I've been spending the past couple of years on. It's much more, at least for me, rewarding to engage in it on that level.
Yeah, and really try to understand what the film's trying to do.
Mm.
I think that's really interesting. Which leads us, to this running down a corridor?
Running down a corridor. So, normally I would ask you what your history with Prometheus is, but I guess we've already done a little bit, gone a little over with the intro, so we'll save that for the next minute. As for right now, Shaw, yes, has fought off Ford and an unnamed security guard.
Who is there just to be an obstruction, clearly. Basically. No identity whatsoever.
Yeah, which is weird because it's a small crew. You'd think we would recognize everyone by this point, but no, there's new faces showing up all the time, I guess, as they were replacing stunt guys? I don't know.
Or new lack of faces in this instance. Mm.
So you've definitely got the most pleasant minutes. You actually did request these ones ages ago.
I did, and I tell you why I want to do this sequence, is because I think, and you know, I've had experience, as you said, storytelling on a smaller scale. I think when you're putting anything together, you're looking at a whole mishmash of scenes, which all serve certain purposes. And there are things which are exposition, and there are things which are character development, and there are things where they're connective tissue. You're trying to get from A to B, and there's always those things where you go, oh, I hope that's right. I hope we've got this. I hope this will engage people. Or, oh, we kind of have to get through this to get to a good part. But then I also think there are just those scenes which are kind of foolproof, where a director knows that this is a scene where the audience is going to shut the fuck up, the room's going to go quiet, and you're just going to have them by the balls.
Yes.
If anyone's seen The Lobster, that very last scene of The Lobster, I won't spoil what it is like that, where you yes. know that they are just holding the audience with this perverse pleasure, knowing that everybody's paying attention there. And I think this sequence sort of has that effect of like a, 27 hours? Am I shortchanging an hour? 28 yeah. hours? That kind of thing where it's a relatively insular scene where you really get to put yourself in that predicament. And a lot of the tension, I don't want to go into too much detail because we'll do it in later minutes, but it becomes about not knowing where it's going to go and how bad is it going to get.
Yeah, because... Well, actually, for a while now, I've been talking about how this film has been subverting expectations. I know that phrase has become a bit of a meme since after The Last Jedi, but hate is gonna hate. It's really subverting what we're expecting from a chestburster. So earlier on, Holloway is infected with the black goo, and you think he's gonna have a chestburster, but he physically starts to deteriorate and maybe transform. You never really know. And then you think, oh, okay. That's glad that's over and done with. Almost immediately, this is basically the scene after. So Holloway is burned alive. Shaw wakes up. Now she finds out she's pregnant. So you think, oh, okay, shit, here's the chestburster. And what unfolds is absolutely not what anyone would have expected.
Yeah, sorry, I got completely distracted by you mentioning Last Jedi and felt a rant coming on because I'm always... so angry at
that,
the way that people fail to understand what is happening in that film.
Yeah, that's another example of quote-unquote fans really not getting the point, or they've very much made up their mind of this is what I want. Same thing with Alien, you know, these old franchises that, well, Alien was a thing that I grew up with, I watched it with my dad, I've got very strong feelings with it. You can say the same thing about Star Wars. And so people get really protective.
But it doesn't really subvert expectations. It's Empire Strikes Back restructured.
Yeah, that's true.
Where the AT-AT battle is the crate battle, so that appears at the end. The whole middle with the training is the beginning of the film. And the ending with Cloud City is the whole casino bit where they meet a rogue who is, you know, is he the good guy, is he the bad guy? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the whole Luke Vader showdown is in the middle as well with the Snoke part. And in terms of like people going, oh, but Luke didn't do what we wanted, etc. I mean, he goes down the exact same path as Yoda and Obi-Wan, both become hermit exiles.
That's very true.
So it's got all these echoes and beats from the original trilogy. And it's so funny how just placing them in a slightly different order really throws people.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if, well, can we say, well, what do we define subversion as? And can we say Prometheus and The Last Jedi are subversive, really? Or are they just sort of playing with existing tropes?
I don't know. Alien's a funny one because I think it's funny because in a way this film is about alien DNA, but at the same time I think people really object to it feeling like it doesn't have the alien DNA.
Yeah.
But the problem is... without going into different areas and exploring slightly different things, all the alien movies end up being that we're introduced to a group of people, they're in a confined space, they get picked off one by one as there is a plan to get from A to B via, I should have said A to C via B. But you know, that sort of, oh, here are the tunnels, we're going to go through here, or we have to go through the reactor, or we have to go through the whatever, and then an alien...
lots of running down hallways.
Yeah, and then someone gets put out an airlock. And it's the same all the time. So, you know, people chasing their own tails with that, I think, a lot of the time. You see that with Force Awakens. Oh, well, this is too similar. And then Last Jedi, oh, well, no, this is too different.
Yeah.
And it's like, and plus you go, well, just, and I feel the same with this as well. You kind of want to go, well, shut the fuck up as well, because it's a trilogy. And if everything you wanted answered and everything that you thought was a whole was explained in the first movie, then it's not a trilogy. You've got nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of trust. And I think that, and you got to remember that back when Empire Strikes Back came out, as a kid, I thought it was boring. People were like, oh, that doesn't have the same feel as Star Wars. And it didn't have a proper ending. And we don't really know if Vader's his father or not. And there's all these people going, no, he's lying. And it's just all a, you know, and it's only after you see it all together where you go, oh, I get it now. I see the thread. I understand what this was.
I really hope we get that for this prequel trilogy. You know,
No, of course we will.
Because, as
we said, hundreds of artists work on these things and they're not idiots. Like, they think about this stuff. Like, the audacity of people online who think, oh, well, I thought about this thing for 5 minutes or 2 minutes. Therefore, I've realized every error that they've made. And because this is that sort of thing where we should get back onto this corridor in a sec.
That's all good additional material.
But I feel like this is that sort of thing where I'm going to use the analogy of graphic design, where you draw up something, you do something, you go through a lot of different variations, you come up with it, and then you show someone and they go, that's good, but would it be better green? And you kind of go, well, I've tried it green, and I've tried it blue, and I've done all these things, and I've made the decision that this is where we should end up.
Yeah.
And people assume that the filmmakers haven't gone through, you know, this usually a year of like design and development or whatever before, or even 2 years before.
Yeah, it doesn't just come out of nowhere.
And you see that like in the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie with the Green Goblin, like no one was happy with that mask. I don't like that mask either. But you can go online, go on YouTube, and you can find test footage of an animatronic Green Goblin head that looked like the comics. You know, they've tried all these things, and for whatever reason, they've made a decision. You know, when you just watch something as an audience for a minute and then draw your opinion, you don't know what they've done beforehand.
Well, in the case of that Green Goblin mask, it was, yeah, it is such a technically difficult thing to do. So that's obviously something I had to consider, especially back then.
I don't even think it's that. I think it was just this idea of, okay, this looks like a supernatural character. This looks like a Halloween character. And we, you know, he's a tech guy.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was thinking, is maybe it's just tone. It was wrong, yeah.
The focus is about tech. It needs to be about armor. It's, you know, that's what suits this character right now. Rather than, oh, but some guy in the 60s, you know. So now let's talk about, look at me taking over. Let's talk about Shaw on the table, about to transition from one room to the next, from a black room to a white room.
Yeah, oh, actually, I got to look at that, because I was recently, in one of the recent minutes, talking about how that room she was in, it was very brightly lit until the minute we're in now. And so I was thinking it was this kind of annunciation scene where David's kind of this archangel telling her that she's pregnant. And then I'm realizing, now you're pointing out that, yeah, suddenly everything's very, what do they call it, where it's low lit, like everything coming from below, and so it's coming off of the tables, it's coming off of the med pod, but everything else is very dark, so I guess it's all in service of tone here.
And we're looking up her bum, essentially, as she's jumping off the table. but this sort of, like, pantsless look, it's very Ripley for me.
Yeah, so we're very much in a similar scenario where she's vulnerable, she is exposed. I was going to talk about this in later minutes, but we'll go into more depth then. But yeah, just the idea of why can't we have nudity in a movie like this? I think it would actually be even more, not shocking in terms of offensive, but shocking in terms of, oh my god, she's just absolutely exposed and vulnerable.
Yeah, I still think she looks that way. I think there's just enough with the legs to remind us that, you know, that feminine aspect, which you don't always see when everyone's wearing the bulky spacesuits.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's a woman and this is a particular bit of body horror, which is about being a woman.
Yeah, that's...
You know, they're starting to put us on that track now.
Yeah, how do we feel about now that the I guess, the chestburster victim, quote-unquote, in this film is a woman, and it's very much about the female body and pregnancy and, you know, it's actually coming out of her... her womb. How does that change the meaning?
I think that the meaning's always been there. It's always been very sexual and very, like, about impregnation. And, you know, the face huggers have got vaginas on them and then turn into this, like, phallic thrusting thing that smashes out of you. Very similar to my own birth, to be honest.
Yeah, because everyone says, you know, it's all about, well, Alien specifically, is all about male fears and male rape and impregnation. And I was thinking, well, what if this was Holloway in this scene, or if just another male crew member going through this, how would it change it?
It wouldn't be presented like this. I mean, this is from very much a female perspective.
Yeah, and I think maybe it serves, well, especially now, speaking of seeing a trilogy, or at least a duology at this point in its entirety, I think what they were always going for with Shaw was this kind of Madonna archetype, very much this Virgin Mary thing. And so we've just had the Annunciation scene, and now here comes this not quite a messiah.
You know, but there's nothing sort of graceful or holy about this. I mean, and this is like agony of childbirth. She's, no. For the moment she gets on her legs, she's staggering, she's falling over, she's in pain. Like, it's something that I would think would be quite relatable to people, which makes it scarier.
It feels like a fairly relatable pain that a lot of us may know about, just stomach pain or menstrual cramps or kidney stones, like you name it. It kind of starts off as this familiar pain, because whereas with John Hurt, it's all of a sudden. It's just, oh, like, it just comes out of him. It's not relatable to most people.
But that, and it's not as natural as well. This is really, like, we're seeing it around the stomach, and this is something nasty that wants to get out. This corridor that she runs down, I think that's interesting. This, and you can tell me, because I haven't studied the movie like you have.
No one has.
Do we see these padded corridors a lot?
Yes. So most notably, you see it when Vickers smushes David's face. You know, she gets right up and kind of claws his face when she realizes he's been talking to Wayland and Wayland won't talk to her.
Because this look with the white gown that does up at the back and the padded walls is total asylum for
me.
Oh,
yeah.
This is like, we are now running directly into craziness, and you've gone from being this high status person to a lunatic in the asylum.
And this is the, roughly at this point, this is the entrance into the third act. So you could read it as her running down this hallway, white padded walls, straitjacket-looking appearance. Yeah, it's like, here's where the madness begins.
Yeah, absolutely, which is, I think, another great justification for her wearing this gown in this sequence, because it really captures that. Plus, it's a tunnel, it's claustrophobic. She's trying to get out of a tunnel while something nasty is trying to get out of her tunnel.
Yes. But that's really interesting that, and this is why I have guests on, just for a different perspective, because in the last few minutes, I was like, okay, I'm going with this Annunciation scene sort of metaphor. You know, David and Shaw are both in pale colours, white and grey and all of that. So I probably would have just gone, yep, that's the only metaphor you can possibly get out of this costume. But no, I think it's conveying much more than just one message. So in the previous couple of minutes ago, David says that the fetus looks like it's 3 months along, and it's like, so, but it's how do you know that, first of all? But does that mean it only needs 3 months to develop? Because it seems like it's ready to come out now.
Oh yeah, we're operating on a very increased time scale, right? This when she comes into this next room, this white room, which has a lot of, it's interesting because you've got a small space inside a larger space, which I think really increases that idea of we're going into somewhere very claustrophobic. I think the there's got to be a deliberate, I'm paused on the doors open with her running towards the pod, got to be a deliberate reference to the original Alien head here with this pod.
Oh, yeah. I never noticed.
With the plastic top that was like the transparent top on the original Alien.
Yeah, which I don't Alien. Like that James Cameron took this off, but oh well.
Yeah, so she's about to get into the alien head here.
Yeah.
The other thing I like about it is she's wearing white. This is a white room. And knowing, as we do, that something horrible is going to happen, it's a blank canvas. Like, we're ready for this place to get messed up.
And boy, does it.
Yeah. So I think that's really anticipatory, this idea of, here are these white walls, this white pod, you're in a white dress, and you know that we're going to be seeing some mess.
Mm-hmm. Let the bloodbath begin. So we hear the med pod ask, please state the nature of your injury. And I tried looking into who does the med pod voice. It's kind of hard to say, but I think it's Annie Penn, and she is the... I figured it out because she's credited as Ship's Computer, but there's a few Ship's Computers. She's the only female one. And she is actually a script supervisor. This is her only acting role. So they obviously just went, we need someone to... You sound good enough. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. They're not paying for that.
Yeah, no. It doesn't matter.
They're going to pay Rob Paulsen to come down and do his, like, fake Liverpool.
Where are my balls, Summer?
Yeah, and this is the problem. The machine's like, I'm not detecting a dick here. You want a cesarean. This is all boner work that we're doing in here.
Yeah, why does gender matter? I know a lot of people said, like, this is one of the criticisms. I might actually add it to the quote-unquote list of flaws. But people go, well, why would this machine not be able to just work on any patient? And it's one of those things that it's not, strictly speaking, logical in terms of a real-world product and how we market things and how we build things. No, it serves a number of functions for the plot, though. It foreshadows Wayland, because, you know, why does Vickers have this med pod? You suddenly, if you are thinking of anything other than, oh God, oh God, oh God, in this scene, you're like, hang on, but isn't this Vickers? This is hers, right? Yeah.
But this is the thing when people try and logicize this stuff, which I think is always crazy, because there's so many other billions of things that you're willing to accept to even go into a movie like this. But the bottom line for me is, if this machine was able to do a cesarean capably and without fuss straight away, would this be a better scene? And the answer is, of course not.
Yeah. And that was the other thing I realized.
And they know that. They know that this is the absolute best way to milk this scene. Yeah, so of course
you get to do a lot of things with Elizabeth's character here. You're showing how she operates under tension. She's terrified, she's in agony, and yet she has to try and work this machine and figure out a way around its limitations. And she doesn't, you know, a lot of people just like would slam at the screen or scream at it. But no, she's like, okay, all right, penetrating an injury, foreign body. Like, she's really clever. She works it out.
And it's setting us up. It's getting our anticipation going, and we're thinking, oh shit, like, is she really going to go through with this? What's going to happen? What are we going to see here? And I think when people lambast something and say, this should have just happened, they think they're solving a problem, but they're not, because there is a whole script that follows that sequence. And you go, how many problems are you creating? Like, how many... That's what I mean about that graphic design analogy of trying all these different things beforehand. It's like, yeah, you might have found a way to plug up this particular thing, but how many things have you opened up because of that? And unless you have the rest of the story for me, you haven't solved the problem.
Mm. And it's also kind of missing the point of, you know, movies. It would be like, oh, well, the plot of, I don't know, Ferris Bueller's wouldn't happen because if he went to school, none of it would have happened. Yeah, exactly. So there's no movie. So, okay.
Yeah, don't watch it. And then for you, it didn't happen. And you can rest easy.
But it's real life. It is like real life in terms of, you know, shit happens and we have to adapt. You're thrown into the deep end. It's not that removed from how reality happens, where we're just kind of pulled along through a random sequence of events. But in the Prometheus, the making of book, in the Furious Gods documentary, there was so much preparation for this scene. So as you were saying before, you know, graphic design, you know, why don't we make it green? This scene, they really did. They tried every single incarnation. So like the shape of the med pod. Now you point out, it's like, oh yeah, of course. There must have been in-depth discussions about that, every detail.
Yeah, yeah, these things don't happen by accident. So, yeah, and then that's the scene, isn't it? I mean, she's just, like, in huge amounts of pain, and this thing opens up, and it's like all the lights go down, and the lights come on in the pod. We're about to stage a show. She's in the stepping into the spotlight.
Yes. This is the tiniest stage in the world.
Fucking bite down on something, audience. It's about to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I think that covers this minute. So, did you have anything to promote? Any links to send people to?
Yep, go to dungeonsanddrongos.com. Drongos is D-R-O-N-G-O-S. That is a live play Dungeons & Dragons podcast setting Fantasy Australia. I DM it, and we've done over 100 episodes, and it's a very funny show, and every couple of episodes is a whole new adventure, a whole story with a beginning, middle, and end. So it's more like a TV show, unlike some of those ones that just go on and on and nothing happens.
Yes, we not naming names, but I do prefer that about your show. Is it is very funny, it's very creative, and it nothing overstays its welcome.
Yep, we keep it moving. Lots of characters, lots of world building, and it's been a lot of fun. Or well, you can go to fruitlesspursuits.com and you'll find I do a movie review podcast that's been a sketchy release schedule of late due to health issues with my co-host. But you'll also find the ScarJo Agogo links on there as well, I think, if you search for that there. But yeah, just go to Fruitless Pursuits, you'll find everything.
All right. That about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.